Welcome to Backyard Oasis, a podcast designed by and for older adults living in the beautiful Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts and produced in the tech studios at Greenfield Community College in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Backyard Oasis reaches out to older adults who seek knowledge to help them live more thoughtfully, healthily, and happily, who hope to inspire others with their ideas, and who serve their communities in the interest of the greater good. We hope you join us frequently in our pleasant backyard oasis for wide-ranging conversations with a diversity of people who are growing older and want to talk about it.
Hi, I'm Denise Schwartz, your host. Dan Conlin is back with us today. You might remember listening to us talk about the insect Armageddon a little while ago. That's the fact that insects are disappearing from our planet faster than we ever thought they would. Studies by researchers, scientists, insect experts, and beekeepers confirm this. And the diminishing population of the insects can be traced to, well, you know, we talked about it, high-intensity agriculture, overuse of pesticides, diminished habitat, and climate change. That episode that we did about all of this was called Where Have All the Insects Gone? And admittedly, it was a pretty grim episode. Today's episode is going to be a bit more hopeful, I hope, because there are some things that individual humans, that's you, that's me, that's Dan, things that we can do in our own small environments, in our homes, in our yards, and in our own thinking that may help mitigate some of the environmental problems we're dealing with now and that lie ahead. And maybe, just maybe, if each of us does something, maybe, just maybe, together our impact will be enough to give us and the insects and plants, the non-human and human animals that share this world with us, maybe it'll give us just a little more time. So Dan Conlin, who's going to be with us again today, let's talk about him. He's a professional beekeeper who, along with Bonita Conlin, manages Warm Colors Apiary in South Deerfield, Massachusetts. They raise bees and they produce honey. They also work with the USDA Agricultural Research Service's Genetics Lab to identify inheritable genes that improve honeybees' defenses against varroa mites and disease. Dan is the past president of the Massachusetts Beekeepers Association, and he was the Massachusetts Beekeeper of the Year a few years back. He's written for bee magazines and contributed to numerous books on honeybee management. And he can talk about beekeeping and the environment until the bees come home. So, hello, Dan.
Hi, Denise. Good to be back.
You are back. And we're going to identify maybe three things we can do on our own. Well, three topics that have a lot of things in them that we can do on our own to protect all of the beneficial insects we know and love and sometimes hate out there. And most importantly, to preserve healthy habitats. Now, I know that when you and I talk, our conversations kind of don't always stay on topic, so I hope our listeners can kind of go along with us as we wend our way through what we say are two topics, but I don't know, could end up being three or four. First, we're going to start talking about pollinator plants for the yard and garden, and then we're going to talk about alternatives to those toxic chemicals and what we can do to preserve a balanced ecosystem. So let's start with those pollinator plants, and I know you're going to have something else to say before we actually talk about those pollinator plants.
I just wanted to open with a quote, and the quote is, "The balance of nature is a complex, precise, highly integrated system of relationships between living things which cannot be safely ignored any more than the law of gravity can be defied with impunity by a man perched on the edge of a cliff." That was Rachel Carson in 1962.
Way back then.
Way back.
Talking about what we're still facing today.
And so you have to look back to those days when things like DDT were still allowed and a lot of stuff we've gotten smarter about. But so much more needs to happen on that path to make this planet a safer and healthier place for everything. Just to back up a touch, I just wanted to restate something about insects, which was Some of the statistics on this are to me overwhelming, because entomologists so far have described about 800,000 to a million different insects on the planet.
Yeah.
Which sounds overwhelming, right?
It does.
Except they also estimate there's at least somewhere between 2 and 30 million they've yet to describe.
Exactly. How can that be when I think most of them are in my garden right now?
That's right, because we're seeing new ones all the time, and that's the amazing piece of it. You know, just among the bees, I think we're up to about 25,000 different bees in the world.
Wait,
that they know about.
Do you mean different species?
Different types of bees.
Different types of bees.
Yes, they're all bees, but anyway, so, and this was another thing, and I don't know how you come up with this stuff, these guys who, but the weight of all the insects in the world is estimated to be something like 27 billion tons, which is six times more than the weight of all the humans.
Wow, they're bigger than us, even though they're smaller than
that's
us.
That's right. So you get an idea that insects are substantial. They're a big part of the environment. And they do represent about 80% of all the animal species in the world.
Okay, wait a minute. 80% of all of the animal species
are insects.
World are insects.
Yes. So,
you know, in a way, I find that frightening.
Well, it's maybe frightening, but it's just, you know, it's all part of what Rachel Carson sort of alludes to, which is these are all creatures that have relationships with each other and the planet. And we're just another one of those species that's out there that has a relationship as well. But there are many of them. And as we talked last time, most things in nature are useful. They're needed. They're part of what makes it all operate properly, right?
So you're going to tell us more about that, because honestly, when I go out in my garden and I see some of the things that are out there, I can't imagine how they're useful. But you're going to tell us.
Well, I can tell you this. If you are in a place where you have a balanced ecology, and this is what our focus today is going to be, is how do you use fewer toxins to kill pests in your garden? Or right now there's a lot of controversy over mosquito spraying,
right?
Because we're seeing some diseases that are very, very dangerous, and we don't want that to become a common issue with the Triple E and the West Nile viruses. These are highly dangerous diseases to humans, and they're passed on by mosquitoes. So, but our reaction as humans is to just spray areas of water with poisons.
Right.
And so the question has to be, all right, so we do have a few cases that do pop up, and I'm not trying to diminish the importance of that, because if you happen to be the one that gets it, it's going to be a horrible experience. But I am also looking at, down the road, what's the long-term effect on the general population with the chemicals being added to our water supply.
Right.
Although they always tell us, at very little risk. But we also know that there's a lot of synergy being occurring in water from other chemicals mixing, and we don't even have a clue what that's going to do. So anyway, not to get off the track.
Well, I think we're going to talk about that in another episode, the big picture, and I want to talk about how we need a cultural shift in terms of how we look at that.
Good.
That idea that, let's just spray it and make it go away, and then we'll have prettier flowers or prettier fruits. We're going to talk about that in another episode. But now what can we do? Let's talk about pollinator plants and why are they so important?
Yeah, let's start with the individuals. In those of us who have a backyard or even more extensive amounts of land that we are stewards to, we need to stop and sort of have an honest conversation with ourselves as to what can we do that's going to both preserve that property and that land and keep it healthy. But also, if we're in the business of growing gardens or flowers or even commercial production of food, how do we do this so that we don't deplete everything and throw that balance, those relationships that are out there, out of whack? Now, why is the balance important? Well, if you have enough swallows, dragonflies, and other predatory type things that eat mosquitoes and mosquito larvae, guess what? You don't have as much mosquito problem.
Yeah, you don't have that disease problem
either,
maybe. That's
right. You cut back on the disease naturally because you have things that are controlling the levels of that creature. And understand, in nature, one of the rules we all think we agree to is simply this. Anytime a particular population of a species gets too overwhelming for the resources in nature, there's a corrective action taken. They're either more predators for that particular creature, or maybe there's a disease that's specific to that creature, but something whittles those populations down, and nature wants to be at a certain level in balance with itself. So there should be hosts and pests and things that sort of even out somehow.
Can you give me an example? And then I want to find out what we can do to make that balance happen, because I go back and forth. It's like, I love my hibiscus, but those little worms are eating the leaves and it looks terrible. And so people are going by going like, what's wrong with our garden? I mean, we're told that they're supposed to be beautiful, but I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And okay. I'm not going to spray chemicals on them. And I can't continually go out there and squash those little bugs, because now don't we need them?
Well, yeah. I mean, to some extent, a lot of that is going to be controlled if you have good bird populations. They're going to eat a lot of that stuff. And there's other things you can do. I mean, there are things you can do naturally to dust those plants, you know. Darris, which is, of course, the main ingredient in things like rotenone. You've heard of rotenone dust.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that, yeah.
Yeah, you can dust them. And it's not without its harmful effects, providing, you know, you're doing it all the time, but you normally would not need to. So one of the keys to controlling, and we're jumping ahead a little bit because I wanted to just sort of mention the importance to creating a better system within your own yard.
Okay, do that, because we can get back to these.
Yeah, and this is really about pollinator plants and what you might want to do to increase the pollinators and the beneficial insects. You know, for example, if you have lots of what we call lace wings and things like that, they feed off of those things. So there's a lot of other insects that can be really beneficial to you if you learn to recognize them. That are going to eat those caterpillars and feed them to their young and things like that. And you don't want to also deplete their populations,
right.
And that's what a lot of these chemicals do. When you hear pesticide, you should be thinking any insect is being affected. So there are some that are more or less beneficial. So it does take a little bit of research, and if you go into any nursery, one of the, probably the two most common problems that people complain about in gardens are caterpillars and aphids.
Aphids, yeah.
Aphids are bad, too.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them, and they affect a lot of different flowers and crops.
Hey, but wait a minute. When you say caterpillars, when I see those little green worms on my hibiscus, those aren't caterpillars. Those are little wormy things.
Yeah, so. But they're going to turn into something else. So.
Well, I'd like to know what they turn into, so I know.
Either beetles or caterpillars, or butterflies or moths, one of those three.
So teeny weeny weeny little worm-looking things can be caterpillars for butterflies?
Yeah, they can, yeah.
Darn.
Absolutely.
Gosh.
Except, you know, they're going to. You have to understand what they are, so that you can know what to do with them.
Okay, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I was just.
That's a good question. I mean, if you don't know what the insect is, and frankly, that's part of what we do as gardeners, not master gardeners who should know better about some of this stuff.
Right.
But I'm saying a lot of us for gardeners, it's kind of like, oh, we got bugs on our plants.
Yeah.
And you don't worry about the bug. You just go get something at the nursery and you say, oh, I've got these bugs. And the guy hands you something and you go back.
You're exactly right.
And you use it. And you don't really read the label. You don't know what's in it. And you're not making a discriminating choice, which is some chemicals aren't as bad as others.
But are they all bad?
No.
Okay.
No, they aren't. I mean, to different degrees. If you're familiar with the integrated pest management thinking, mm-hmm. It's basically you have to identify your problem early when it's the least least damaging to your plants.
Yes.
And then you would use the least the lowest strength treatment that you need to. And you kind of, as it gets worse, you move up the line, and at this end, you're using some pretty hard chemistry to contain a big problem, right?
Right now, it's almost impossible to fix this.
So the trick is you have to get to it earlier.
Okay, but Dan,
if you ever work with an orchardist,
No, I have to remember what I'm going to say.
I was just saying, if you ever work with an orchardist, they will tell you that they you know, for apples and things like that, there's a certain amount of spraying that goes on just automatically.
Oh, I remember.
But they're anticipating certain problems, and they're staying ahead of it. Because if they stay ahead of it, it doesn't require a lot of chemicals, just a maybe a treatment, and then it's done before it gets so big that they have to do multiple sprays and maybe some harder chemistry, which you don't want to do. So there's choices you can make. It takes a little education.
And how do we get that, though? See, that's what I was going to interrupt you and say, okay, well, who do I call when I first see that little caterpillar on my... How do I know?
Yeah,
I know there are apps and things that can identify them, but...
Yeah, there's a lot of information if you just Google things like, give me an organic treatment for whatever the insect is you're trying to control.
That's a lot of work.
I get it on my phone, and mine I talk
okay,
to.
Okay, so you just tell me what I need to do. I call you.
Well, yeah, I'm going to tell you, just pick up your phone and decide what you're going to use.
Okay.
If you have a nursery that you go to regularly, most of those guys know about the chemicals. They should. And if the guy you're talking to doesn't, ask for somebody who knows and tell them you really want to have a treatment that's going to do the least harm to pollinators and non-targeted insects.
What's that mean?
When you talk about pesticides, they are generally, there's a lot of different ones for the simple reason that they are often specific to a certain problem, a certain insect, a certain fungus, certain something. So there's a lot of general pesticides, but there's also pesticides that target certain populations. And they often are specific enough to that they may not be as toxic to things like bees or butterflies or other things that might visit. So there is for example, currently there's probably 179 approved chemicals that are allowed to be sprayed.
Wait a minute.
And those are 100% terrible for bees.
I was just going to say. Who's approving them? Like the manufacturers? I mean, that's ridiculous.
They have to have the EPA and government agencies sign off on them. So.
Oh yeah, but say that Roundup's not going to hurt anything.
Now we have
people who are like, they all have cancer. So
well,
anyway,
well, the other.
Oops,
but,
hope nobody like takes me to task for saying that. But
well, no,
I
it's
see
true.
This stuff on television
no,
saying if
true.
You use Roundup, you may be entitled to.
Yeah, well, that's getting into our next
talk. Episode.
So our next episode, because yes, that's a legitimate complaint. Roundup is a bad thing to have.
It's bad.
But the reason it's really bad is if it was just used in very isolated situations, very occasionally, it would not be a big thing. But it became the common spray along every roadside in the country.
Oh, and every
for years.
Crack in your sidewalk.
Yeah. So they were using millions of tons of this stuff.
Good point.
So, and it was overuse. If we just minimize what we're spraying, we'd have a better environment as well. But
that's a very good point, Dan, and that's what an individual person can do.
Yeah.
Don't use Roundup and that stuff at all, but minimize your use of other things, but use it where you need to. Like things like neem oil. I know my dad used to use neem oil, but then I went on and I read it. It says neem oil is the go-to treatment for most garden and household plants. It harms the biological and reproductive systems of insects, but is completely safe for humans.
Well, that's true.
So I'm reading it going like, okay, like I'm getting like a real mixed message here. Should I use neem oil? I don't know.
Well, that's also a good statement because most of the determination of whether things get approved is weighted towards the effect on mammals.
Uh-huh, yes, right.
Obviously, it's an insecticide because that's what they're marketing it as. However, the concern is more like, is this going to mess up my DNA?
or they say, or for pets, my dog, if it licks it, my dog will be okay.
Right.
But that really isn't proven.
So I mean, that is a good point because sometimes things get through the system because they're not looking at the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Or is that necessarily what they're trying to do? So it's only in recent years that we've become more focused on doing something about the declining pollinators because we do, at least those people who have pushed these things through as leaders in this country recognize that, no, we can't be messing with this too much because it really is a real thing.
Yeah,
it's
we are starting to become really aware of that.
It's a real issue, and it's going to come back to really hurt us in the future.
Okay, so nematodes.
Nematodes, well, you know, again, that's another thing. You can put something in the ground if you want, or you can wait for something to balance it out. And that's for the things that we're never good at. Now, to me, part of my thing has always been that we don't do any of this on our 80 acres of land. And for the most part, you know, we have some issues sometimes. But you know what? We can kind of keep up with our little garden, vegetable garden, in the sense that if you go out once a day and pick off what the caterpillars and throw them in a can of...
Oh, yeah, but don't we want those caterpillars?
Maybe, maybe not if they're eating all your vegetables. Well, you're just protecting your vegetables. If you don't see that at all in our yard, though, early spring or in the early part of the season, because
the
we have so many birds eating caterpillars, they're just there. They're in the garden all day long.
Okay. So
very little gets going. This time of year, you see a lot of that sort of plant predation from insects.
Yes.
And it's not even so much that it's caterpillars. I mean, but then on the other hand, we're also growing milkweed so we can encourage monarchs. Because we want them to be around. And it's sad because I have seen such a decline in our area with the monarchs. And the problem with that, of course, is that they're migratory. So they tend to migrate south and north generationally. And I think they don't have proper habitat or forage to continue that. So it's broken up too much, too fragmented.
Right. There's not that long corridor that there used to be.
And to the credit, there's a group in Franklin County that's been trying to address that and encourage people to do more with it. And I applaud them because I think they are making a difference. And in the long run, I think it's probably one of those group and individual things that we can all do for various creatures we want to live.
I think you're right. Okay, so I have this little plot of milkweed that just came up, and I'm keeping it there this summer. And today there are two pretty little caterpillars out there. They are big. They're not
green,
little.
Yeah.
They're little striped guys. Yeah,
okay,
they're really nice.
Monarch, yep.
Okay, so as an individual, I don't know what to do. Well, there were three, and now there are two. What happened to the other one? I don't know. I try to pay attention to this stuff, but I honestly don't know. What do I look at now? What do I do for those caterpillars as they're eating? And then where do they go? How do I see the next stage?
They're gonna morph, go into their metamorphosis and chrysalis, and then they will mature and they'll hatch out as a butterfly.
Right, but where do they go?
They're going to be on that plant somewhere.
They're going to stay on the milkweed when they do their chrysalis.
Yeah, they'll be just hanging there. They'll turn into this little gray thing.
I hope they get
thing.
To that point.
Well, that's just it. They may not, but you know the thing about, of course, the relationship with the monarch caterpillar and the milkweed is the milkweed is distasteful to predators.
Everybody else.
Yeah, and then, of course, the monarchs have evolved to actually be able to eat that plant.
Yeah, good for them.
You know, so that's their defense. And so, you know, again, nature's got a relationship, right? So that's the relationship with them.
So
but that's the sort of the sad part of the story of the monarchs is that it isn't a lack of it isn't that something's eating all of them or killing them all off. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like it's just that habitat is missing.
There are no fields of milkweed around where we are anymore.
Yeah. And that to me, that's sad. It's not even like you can, you know, raise more of them and have it be all right. There's a gap there we can't control very easily, you know. But anyway.
Okay, give me a few other things because we still have to talk about the birds
and
the bees.
Yeah, so quickly, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the pollinator plants because we're jumping over that, which is so critical. Ultraviolet light is something that most of these pollinators see. Bees see ultraviolet, so they see into hues you and I cannot see. Now, what does that mean? Well, you probably have recognized that with flowers, they have color phases. When they're fresh and new, they're sort of vibrant and look really, really
beautiful.
Great. Then they'll sort of fade and get a little rough, and then they'll eventually go to seed, right?
That's what's happening now.
Yeah, so each of those phases is actually a signal to the pollinator, I'm ready. I've got pollen, and I've got the need to produce seeds, and it attracts them. And the other thing that we we have to recognize with flowers is nectar guides.
Yeah, tell me about those.
Well, the nectar guides is a way that the flowers entice their pollinator to come to them. So it might be that pink kind of, you know.
He's smiling. The pink smile that the flower makes, well, he's trying to
well,
say.
Well, for example, some of them will have stripes on the flower that lead to the center where the pollen and Yeah, so the bees will know that's theirs. The length of the nectaries, for example, some nectaries, which are the little filaments or tubes that hold the nectar, the sweet nectar, that's really just a treat for the bees. Think about this. The only reason plants produce that is to entice pollinators. Otherwise, it's a huge draw on their energies, their energy reserved.
Oh, the plant's energy reserve.
Yes, to produce that nectar. They don't need that nectar. They're giving it away as an enticement to come pollinate.
Oh, it's like when somebody comes to visit, you give them snacks.
That's right.
Oh, well, same thing.
It's kind of like in nature. Or with your dog. Here, good job sitting. Here's your treat. Right,
exactly.
Well, you know, nature's not stupid, and somebody figured that one out.
We're all part of it.
You know, Pavlov figured that one out. You know, you give something that somebody really wants, they'll keep coming back.
So the flowers really, I know, I started reading that. It was a fabulous book about what they actually do, and we think, oh, they're just looking pretty, but they're not.
No.
They are designed a certain way for a certain thing.
And then you kind of get into the other piece, which is the fragrance.
Oh yeah,
and we humans like flowers for the same reasons bees do. In some ways, we like the look, we like the smell, but there are also flowers that stink. They don't smell very well at all, because their primary pollinators are flies, so they will smell really bad to attract flies for pollination. Bees won't have anything to do with them. So there's...
That is so cool. Well, what are they? Can you name some of them, or do we want to move on to something else?
Well, I've seen some of them. They have something called stinkweed down in Georgia that's, I think, one of those plants.
But well, there are other ones like Russian sage that doesn't smell so great.
Yeah, well, you see bees on that, though.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Then I guess it smells good for them.
But, the point of that is that, you can look at, for example, when we are looking for good bee locations to produce honey, sometimes you will look at things like multifloral rose. There's fields of it sometimes.
Fields of it, yeah.
And it smells great, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it looks great.
It looks pretty.
Invasive as all get out.
But why is that bad? It's just growing.
Bees don't have any use for it.
Oh, really? Bees don't care about that?
Honeybees don't. So for us, that's not an enticement for me as a beekeeper to set up a bunch of beehives near there. Because they aren't going to benefit from that.
Well, which flowers would you want to have around?
Well, right now we have goldenrod.
Oh, and bees like that?
They love it.
Because?
Because it's just one of their plants. And there's about 20 varieties of goldenrod. And we had something called the BB tree that just was out in bloom recently. And that blooms for over a month. It's Elodia, one of the Elodia species.
BB tree?
We call them BB trees.
I don't know what that is.
Well, okay. I'll have to show you. I'll give you some seeds. They're fantastic.
I don't have any more room.
I know.
I can't plant anything else.
And the other one that we have on our property is a yellow wing stem, which are about 5 foot tall, and they're all yellow, and they're blooming right now. And you see every kind of pollinator on those, and they're long blooming. They go for a good month, and they produce a very nice light yellow honey that's very tasty. So there's... There's a lot of plants we track, and we actually have a whole list from spring to fall. And one of the things, if you're trying to attract pollinators, is to have things blooming early in the season, through the mid-season, into the late fall. So, usually asters are your last wild plants that you see, because they go late. But you will see all the pollinators going to those. And with the goldenrod, it starts actually the beginning of August and will run well into September, because there's a lot of different varieties. And by the way, you will not see the honeybees on all of them. Certain ones they don't like.
Why not?
They just don't have a
taste for it.
They don't have a care for it.
It's not funny. They're so individual. They're individuals.
But that's part of the whole key to this relationship. You need all the pollinators, because some pollinators actually only pollinate certain plants. In Madagascar... There are thousands of orchids, different orchids, and they have solitary bees for each of those orchids that are attracted to just that fragrance. So That's really cool, isn't it?
It's cool, but is it really?
So there's thousands of different types of solitary bees on Madagascar.
Wow.
So that's, I found that to be fascinating.
You would, and you're a beekeeper.
But anyway,
I know, it's fascinating.
But it just talks about, you know, to the point that nature is very complex, and there's room for everything at some point, you know, providing you don't change it too much. So,
okay, so
I know we're running short of time.
We're running short of time already, and I wanted to learn more, and we haven't even really talked about the birds and the bees, Dan.
Well, I would just leave us with this thought. You know, the birds and the bees are really... the birds, of course, in my mind, are one of your best control of pests in your gardens. They like a lot of the stuff that we consider pests. But the other things to keep in mind are wasps and yellow jackets. Mm. Yellow jackets love to feed on maggots from flies. So if you want to have a low fly problem, leave the yellow jackets alone. You won't have a fly problem. Then the wasps, what do they go after? They go after those caterpillars.
Do they?
Yes, they do.
And do you know what else they do, Dan?
What's that?
I have a fig tree. Do you know what wasps do with fig trees?
No.
They love the fruit of fig trees. Oh, I hope I can remember all of this. They actually go inside a ripening fig on my fig tree.
Yeah.
And they go in there and they get, is it pollen or is it nectar?
Probably nectar.
Nectar.
Probably the
from
sweetness.
Those tiny little, we think they're seeds inside the fig, but those are actually the flowers. A fig is an inverted flower.
Wow.
So when I have a lot of, we have a lot of wasps flying around our house, and people come over to visit, and they're like, a wasp. And we're like, no, they're fine. They're not going to hurt you.
Yeah.
And they just fly around and they go and they make my fig tree have delicious figs.
Cool.
See, you didn't know that, did you?
I didn't, because we don't really see a lot of figs up here.
This is pretty amazing that Dan...
I know you...
I know something I know that you, Dan doesn't know.
I know you carry fig trees inside in the winter. And
yeah, they live in my garage in the winter.
I haven't quite got to that point yet, but...
Well, okay, so hey, this is a good way to kind of like wind down.
But
there's so much to talk about. And you know what? We're going to talk about some other things in another episode. So what we're going to do is wind down now, but I'm going to be quiet and let you finish up this episode.
Okay, just let me summarize a couple of things about what we were starting to talk about. And if you want to lower the risk to bees and other beneficial insects, there's a few rules you could look at. Don't spray unnecessarily. Follow IPM thresholds, which is you see a few things, you go with a very mild treatment. And you have to, you know, you can go through Extension Service or any of these groups, have this stuff listed on their sites. It's not a hard thing to look up. There's plenty of advice out there. The simple thing is don't spray your plants while they're in bloom.
Oh.
If they're blooming, that's the interest for pollinators. If there's no flowers, they have very little pollination, or they have very little interest in visiting those plants. So if you spray off the bloom period, most plants, you're minimizing risk to the native pollinators.
That is a very good thing to remember. I never thought of that.
Yeah, and the other thing is, a lot of the be aware of your half life of these chemicals. A lot of these break down in the sun. When the sun comes out, it neutralizes them.
How would we know that?
It'll say it on the label. Read the directions.
Dan. The typeface is about 2 inches, but you know, it's so small I can't read anything.
Yes, I know, and that's really something that that those of us concerned about this have complained to the government and to the companies many times. Oh yeah, people complain about
you
that.
You can't
all the
read
time.
It.
That's right. So you say to people, you've got to follow the directions, right?
And then you can't
legally,
read the
legally, you're bound to that. I mean, you could be, even as an individual, getting fined for being off-label. However, the defense is, I can't read that.
I can't read that.
I'm 74 years old, and my glasses aren't that great anymore. What do you want to do, right?
Oh, boy.
So anyway, you know, and or you apply the chemicals after the bees aren't flying, which is dusk to dawn. So spray at night, and you'll be fine. You'll get the most effect, by the way, because a lot of times that's when these plant predators are feeding. They're out there in the dark a lot of the time.
Spray
night. Why are they in the dark? Because a lot of things that eat them aren't flying around. Right?
Spray at night. If anybody listening comes away with one good tip, that's it. Spray at night.
And then there's a couple just other kind of things. One is it don't use aerosol cans.
Oh, no. And no, never.
But those are designed to be used indoors, not outdoors. And the reason is they're high pressure and they produce very small droplets. Now, small mm-hmm. droplets are light, and they even a slight breeze causes them to drift to place away. To non-targeted places, right?
Okay, very good.
And we know about targeted. We're targeting a certain plant or a certain leaf or the things on the leaf.
Good point.
And if it blows over, 5 feet from here on something that isn't the target, you not only have you wasted the effort, you've also potentially contaminated something that doesn't need to be. And then that's if you follow that, and always read the label and follow directions, and don't do the typical American thing, which is double the dose. Don't do that. Which is the other thing. Don't overdo it. Don't spray too many times. Don't do it all the time. A lot of these things that are used for this, by the way, you won't see in maybe initial reduction in the pest. It may take a couple of days because a lot of these things are activated by eating some of it, ingesting it. So that doesn't.
Oh, so that's not like you're spraying to kill them immediately.
That's right. A lot of times these are slower acting, but those also tend to be the safer ones, okay?
Well, not for the insect.
Not for the insect, of course. But, and understand that a lot of this stuff you really want to pay. I just can't get past this with also reminding humans. Us humans aren't necessarily immune to any of this stuff. So protect yourself. Wear a mask. Don't breathe it. Wear some gloves.
Really?
Absolutely. You know, one of the disservices that when I was asked to give testimony on some of these things, one of the first things I said is, you guys need to change the rules because farmers and licensed applicators understand the dangers of handling this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The average homeowner is spraying this stuff all over the place while they're talking on their phone or have their kids out there with them, and this stuff is being breathed, getting in your eyes, and right on label to say, don't let it touch your skin.
Good point.
So recognize you're dealing with some dangerous chemicals for yourself. So protect yourself. Wear long sleeves, gloves, wear a mask. Goggles, protect yourself. So that's kind of my advice on how you might reduce your contribution to harming beneficial insects.
I appreciate it.
Some of these rules are just changing your habits a little bit.
Changing our habits, not anything that's good to do. One of our habits, Dan, is that we like to talk, and I think we're going to have to change our habit right now and kind of say adios.
Adios.
And I do want to say that we are going to do another episode, but it's not going to be on individual efforts. It's going to be talking more about the big picture, and I'm really looking forward to that. It's going to talk about food waste and how the government we perceive often is not really helping us in terms of environmental impacts that are positive, but that there is some information in which government has done some really good things. We're going to be doing that next. So once again, thanks a lot. I know now because of this conversation, I will, in the middle of the night, be outside spraying my gardens, and I hope the neighbors don't worry about it. Dan, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be here, Denise.
See you later.
This concludes today's podcast. We're always looking for new ideas, so feel free to reach out to Judy Raper, Associate Dean of Community Engagement at Greenfield Community College at 413-775-1819 if you have an idea you'd love to share. Special thanks to the creators of Backyard Oasis, Denise Schwartz, Chad Fuller, Dennis Lee, and Christine Copeland. Have a great day.